Good afternoon. So last time we talked about TLB. So we learned that we had this page table lookup, and it provided us all this flexibility for operating systems to do these nice tricks with memory and having your program have one view of memory versus the system. But the system we talked about for implementing them was pretty inefficient. It involved kind of amplifying all our memory accesses several times. So when we had a four-level page table, basically we'd have, 5x the memory accesses, including instructions and data, and that wasn't acceptable. Even if all those memory accesses would be cache hits. So we added this special extra cache that is going to be super fast because it's super small, which was the TLB. So this was a cache that maps virtual page numbers to page table entries. And we learned now, since we take virtual page numbers, we're going to divide up our virtual page number into a TLB index and a TLB tag. And our TLB blocks in our cache, TLB is going to be each a page table entry, so we don't have any offset bits to deal with. And we're going to put this through our TLB, and we're going to get out a page table entry when it's a hit. If it's a miss, well, we're going to do our normal page table lookup, going through all the levels like your page table code should do for the assignment, and put that result into our TLB. Then we started talking about our next topic, which is about using multiple threads. So we talked about threads earlier when we said, okay, a process is composed of an address space. So that's the thing we implement with virtual memory, that it's like looks like each program has its own memory with the OS's choice of whatever we want at each address, and also has its own threads. And we said a thread was kind of our virtual processor. Each thread has its own program counter, its own registers, and it's kind of like you have a core to yourself for each thread you have. But so far, we've used multiple threads, but only through using multiple processes. We've had one thread per process. We did create new threads, but we did that by creating a new process, which happened to make a new thread for a process. So now we're talking about creating new threads within the same process. So how does that work? Well, we had our extra thread that shared these sort of per process resources that weren't part of the thread. And most notably, that meant we had the same open files, because all the files we have open, that's part of the process, not part of the thread. All the memory, part of the process, part of the thread. But we had sort of not shared, we had our stack, and I'll put an asterisk, and our register values. So those were all things that were managed per thread. And I have an asterisk on the stack because we have our own stack, but it's in the same address space, right? The way that's going to work is we're going to allocate memory in the same addresses, but at a different location, because we can't have two things allocated at the same place for the stack of the new thread. And we mentioned, okay, so we want to create threads, and we started talking about the pthreads API for doing this. This is the API that Linux supports. And here we have a function that pthread create that's kind of analogous to fork. So unlike fork, pthread create did not make the very confusing choice of having the function return twice. Instead, pthread create takes a function to start the thread in, and it runs that in the new thread and just returns in the existing thread. And we had this function pthread join, which is kind of like wait PID. And like wait PID, it collects a return value from the thread. In the case of our threads, these return values are void pointers, not small integers. And it doesn't have the status information we saw with wait PID, like If the thread crashes, you don't find out from pthread join, you find out because the whole process crashes. So it doesn't need to tell us about that. And I guess I should mention, since I don't think we were explicit about it last time, you know, with wait PID, we had to wait for our child thread, child processes. Pthread join has no such restriction. You can wait for any thread in the current process with pthread join. So questions on things we covered last time? Okay, so I want to talk about one thing on the quiz that a lot of people missed. And this is on our last set of questions. We had a function main that created a thread, created two threads actually, but that ran foo. And the function foo had some local variables, and so did main. So main had a local variable p1, and foo had a local variable p1. And the question that about 30 people missed, it asked like about basically where are these two variables stored? So first of all, most important thing is these are different variables. They have independent values, because foo and main can be running at the same time, and foo expects to be able to modify p1 without it modifying main's p1 and vice versa. So they definitely have different values, meaning they have different physical addresses if they're stored in memory. And they're probably stored in memory because they were passed to pthread create, so we need to make a pointer to them, so they can't be in registers. They have to be in memory somewhere for that pointer to work. And these two threads are running in the same process. So this means that the process, since the process has one shared virtual address space, it has the same page tables for every single thread, that they have to have, the thread stacks have to be at different places. So we have a stack for main, for the original thread, and we have a stack for the new thread. And those have to have different virtual addresses because otherwise they can't be in the same page table and be different stacks. And if they aren't different stacks, well, these functions are going to get very confused. Because each thread needs its own stack, we can't like return to another thread that way. And these are local variables, so they're going to be stored on our stack. So they're stored on our stack, the two stacks, because they exist in the same process and are from two things running simultaneously, have to be at different locations. So you have to have two different virtual addresses. So I assume like a big point of confusion is that this is not what happens like if we forked to create foo. In that case, we'd have two different address spaces, so we could have two different things at the same virtual address, because there'd be two different processes. But with only one process, one virtual address has to have the same value across all the threads of the process. Okay, so questions? Out. Quiz question 6. Okay, so one logistical reminder. Page table 2 is due tomorrow before the first lab. That is a strict deadline. Yes, I know some of you are in the later labs. We don't want to play the game of finding out that everyone suddenly needs to go to the 6:30 lab and so they can get an extra 3 hours on the assignment and run out of space. So we're not doing that. It's due at 3:29. And no late policy applies. If you need a late submission for some good reason, you should talk to me. Yes?
I have a question on number 5.
Number 5? Okay. So question on number 5, you can do that first, yeah. So I guess in number 5, what was happening is we pthread create foo, we join this for 1, we join 1, we p-thirt create foo for 2, we join 2, and 1, each instance of foo, p-thread creates bar, which we'll call, say, 3, and p-thread creates another bar, which we'll say call 4, and it joins 3. So each call to foo leaks a thread bar, basically. Leaks one thread running bar, doesn't, and that's how we got the total count. Yeah. So question 4 doesn't die when 2 dies? Yes. So this was true in processes too, right? In the case of processes, just because the parent process goes away doesn't mean the child process does. And in the case of threads, just because the thread that created you goes away doesn't mean you go away. If the main dies, then that's a special case because the code that calls main, so the compiler code, is the sort of actual start, is basically does xset main dot dot dot. This is the compiler code that runs. That's why that's a special case, is that something has to call main. The code that calls main is the code that calls xset. For our new threads, the code that runs those threads doesn't exit the whole process, or it doesn't exit anything when the thread terminates, because there's no reason to do that. For main, it does that because you'd be really confused if returning from main didn't get rid of your process in a clean way. Yeah?
I have a question on for the first question on quiz.
Okay.
Why would we have a tag that would correspond to the entire virtual page number instead of like just the small bit that corresponds to the last level page?
Question is, on number 1, why does the TLB tag have the whole virtual page number and not just the part for the last level? So the TLB, if we think of our scenario, we take our virtual page number and page offset. When we have a TLB hit, we take this whole virtual page number, put it in the TLB, and get out our page table entry. Now, it's true that when we have a TLB miss, what's happening is we're going to split up the virtual page number into parts, right, and do our lookup with each part, with a step for each of the virtual page number parts to get out our same page table entry. But the TLB lookup, when it's successful, uses the whole virtual address because it skips all those steps. And therefore, the tag needs to account for that. And in particular, like if we have something from one of the several last level tables, we need different TLB entries for each one. Does that answer your question?
Okay. And then would it store the entry from the last level table?
Question: would it store the entry from the last level table? Yes. So generally, the TLBs that we've talked about don't bother storing any of the earlier levels. So you're not crazy to think maybe that would be beneficial, and there are processors which have some caches for those data structures, but it's a lot less helpful than storing the last levels. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
There's a question on question 5, when there's the leaked thread, what will wait on the leaked thread?
Question, when there's the leaked thread in question 5, what will wait on the leaked thread? Nothing. So if it doesn't exit before main exits, then it gets terminated when main exits. If it does exit, well, as we'll talk about later today, it's going to leak memory because there actually will still be some bookkeeping information in case you wanted to join it, which even though we know it never gets joined, but the pthreads library doesn't know that. Does that answer your question? Yeah?
I had a question about question 4 on the quiz.
Okay. So question 4 was asking, could these two addresses be in different sets? And the scenario for that is that if we think of how the way that our TLB worked here is we had our address, right? We had our page offset and our virtual page number. And if we compared that to our L1 offset and L1 index, we have this kind of overlap here. And the cache, according to the question, uses physical addresses. So what the cache is getting is a physical page number and a page offset. So the physical page number plus part of the page offset is what makes the cache index. And we're just told the virtual page number. So we know that these parts of the two addresses are the same, but we don't know that the physical page number, bottom bits of the physical page number are going to be the same. Because that depends on the page table mapping we've chosen. So even though it's true that the virtual page number part, that's the same, that's not what matters for the cache. Does that answer your question? And I guess I would say, as I alluded to in lecture, this design is typically deliberately not chosen by modern processors because they really want to do the cache lookup with just the page, start the cache lookup with just the page offset. But if you don't do that, which is a reasonable choice, then yeah, you'll have these sort of things where just because the addresses look similar doesn't mean they go to the same set. And as far as why would it be a reasonable choice, if you look at what modern processors have done to avoid this situation, they've increased the associativity of the L1 caches, you know, which obviously has a performance impact. But they felt it's worthwhile because it makes it so they can start the lookup faster. Other questions on the quiz? Okay, so back to our logistics. So page table 2, it's due before the first lab. If you have some reason you can't make that, you should talk to me. And it's due there because we want you to submit what you're actually going to go over with other students in the lab. So this is a code review activity. This is not a debugging activity. This is a code organization and style feedback activity. It's not a have some of my fellow student debug my code activity. That's not the purpose. And you'll be showing code on your screen. You do not send your files to other students. And we're also asking you to submit what you're showing, so like we can see what changed. You know, we don't expect your code to suddenly become exactly like someone else's. And that's in lab, and I'm mentioning it mainly because I know from experience that if I don't talk about there being a strict deadline, some people will seem to forget about it. And we can make accommodation for people who can't make that deadline, but we need to talk. It's going to be something, it involves changing what you do for the lab. So that's a consideration for us. So questions on page table 2 logistics? Okay, so when we finished up last time, we were looking at, you know, our example of passing values to threads, and we finished up with this example where we decided, okay, I didn't want to write two different functions that were basically the same just to have my two threads do different things. So I decided, well, there's this ignored argument thing, maybe I should not ignore that. And so our simplest solution for not ignoring that is say, okay, I just want to know whether I'm thread 0 or thread 1. I'm going to pass that in my argument, and unfortunately my argument needs to be a void star, because that's the only thing pthread create supports. So I'm just going to shove a number in my pointer and take the number out. And kind of when this runs, you know, we have this scenario where, you know, we're still, we have these global variables here, so we're taking advantage of these threads being in the same process a whole lot. The only kind of thing which distinguishes them is the different arguments we've passed. Because we're running the exact same code. You know, they'll have different program counters because they'd be, you know, different places in the loop potentially, but, you know, the way this function knows which elements to access is going to be based on the argument I. Now, you might consider this a little ugly, and we're going to slowly work towards getting rid of global variables. Because you've probably been told in some other classes at some point that maybe this is bad style. And we've sure been doing a lot of global variables for everything when probably our function should not work that way, right? They should take their work on their arguments, not work on extra global stuff if it, you know, unless there's a good reason for that. But, you know, there's a question of like, how do we make this happen? So we'll start out by getting rid of, well, by simple, you know, getting rid of and generalizing a few things. So one thing that's kind of not nice here is that I've kind of hard-coded 512 here, right? So my thread function, it's more generic now. I don't need to write two different versions for the two different threads. But I've hard-coded in my function that the array, you know, is going to be processed in 512 element chunks. You know, that's pretty inflexible. I'd like to be able to use this code for different sizes of arrays. And it seems like a real challenge right now because I can pass one number for that. And also my array is a global variable which I have to declare with some size. So we're going to work on fixing that. And I'm going to start by fixing this idea here that our bounds are just 512 times something. We're going to make that more generic. And by fixing that our results go into this global array. And the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to make a struct to hold the things I want to pass to the thread. Because my big problem is I want to pass multiple things to the thread, and my argument only conveniently holds one pointer. I also want to return things from the thread, and I could use the return value from pthread join, but if I'm passing a pointer, I might as well just reuse that, and that's what I've chosen to do here. So I have this struct here, where I'm going to have two items in the struct that are going to be set set by the what I'll call the driver function. So the function that sets everything up, you know. And I'll have one thing here that is going to be set by the thread function. And the thread needs to know about how to find all these values. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to allocate some space for them just as a local variable in my driver function, some all here. And I'm going to set the values I'm setting in the driver function there and pass a pointer to the struct to each of the thread functions. And they can use that pointer after some type conversion because we need to convert back from a void star to a pointer to struct. We can use that to set our start and end location, and also we can write to it, you know, using the pointer, you know, to modify the result variable, and then I can sum up the two results after I know the threads are finished. How do I know the threads are finished? Because I can just call join. So I know after join for joins, they must be done. So questions? So when this runs, we're going to have this info array, and each of the two threads are going to have their own stack, and their local variables are going to be either in their registers or on their stack, and we're going to point to that info array. But we're still summing up stuff in this globals array that they're both accessing kind of directly. So questions about how passing this struct is working? Okay, so I have the one disappointing thing that makes my function rather non-generic is that I have this values global array. That's all the functions can act on. So let's extend this to make it so that values array, you know, doesn't need to be a global. And I can do that by just modifying my struct to pass in a pointer instead of using the global. So in this case, I make my driver function take the pointer to start with. In this case, the size is like fixed at 1024, but that would be easy to change. I could add a new argument to sum all and change its computation of start and end. The thread function doesn't need to change to do that, in fact. The thread function is you know, just works the way it is. And that's just another thing I set when I set up those info structs. And we have our same idea that we're getting our sort of info struct through that argument. You know, it's shoved into a void star and converted back because keythreadcreate only lets us pass void stars. So if we think of, and we're still passing the result back through the struct. So if we think of what's happening, we have our two threads. Now they have pointers to the info array, and that has pointers to values which are somewhere. We don't really care where. Could be on the stack, could be on some stack, could be on the heap, etc. So questions about scenario here. So something you might find a little disappointing about this code here is that we're doing a bunch of work to start threads, and then we're doing nothing. We're just waiting for them to finish. You know, that, you know, so that's kind of like wasting a thread. You know, a thread's not doing anything useful. So one solution to this might be that maybe we should start one less thread and actually call some thread to do the work of one thread. Another thing we could imagine is we could make a version of this function which kind of works in the background. So here I have this idea that rather than calling a sumAll function, you know, we're doing the sum in separate threads. Those threads run independently of the rest of the program. So why not make it so I can start the summing, do a bunch of work, then finish it later on? And we can do that, but we need to put our info array somewhere else, right? Because the problem here is that the threads have a pointer to this info array that's on our stack. When this function returns, that goes away. Now, this wasn't the problem here, because the threads don't go away until after sumAll returns because it joins. But you know, if we, in this case, I'm creating the threads in one function and joining them in another, if I passed a pointer to a local array, well, that local array wouldn't be there the whole time the threads were running, and that would be a problem. So what I've done instead is I've allocated space for those info structs on the heap, and in my finish function, I've just remembered to free that space so I don't leak memory. Questions? Design here. And so we're passing each thread a pointer to part of that heap allocated array. Oh, and also, something we're doing is that I needed some place to put the thread ID, because when I join a thread, I need to pass the thread ID I got from keythreadcreate. And my solution to that was, well, I'm already allocating this info struct, I can just put some bookkeeping information in there. You know, maybe if we didn't like to pass that through threads, we could have like a separate array we allocate, but we're already allocating one, we can add stuff to it, it's a struct. So I just chose to put it in there, even though it's not useful for the threads themselves, but it's useful for the finish function. And so what's happening here is now the threads are running, and they have a pointer to stuff that's on the heap. Yeah, so they can run independently of the rest of the program. So questions about my info on the heap example? So this is kind of our most generic way to pass things to threads. So since we've talked a bit about passing to threads, let's go through this example here. So here I have some code, and something is wrong with it. So you take a look at it, talk with your neighbor, what is wrong with this code? And as far as what this code is intending to do, we're calling this create string thread, we're creating a thread, we're joining it, and we're getting back the return value, the string here, and printing it out. And when I get back the return value, well, it's returning a pointer. I'm getting passing a pointer to the pointer for pthread join and filling. And there's something wrong with this code. If you run it, it won't work. You'll do something that you'll definitely say is not working. Would like some more time? Okay, any volunteers to say something that's wrong with this code? Yeah.
Strings on the stack in the function.
Okay, strings on the stack in the function?
Right.
And why is that a problem?
We can't get it because the stack is going to go away when we close the thread, and we're trying to get a pointer.
Okay, so your observation, string is on the stack, and it's going to go, that stack is going to go away when the thread is joined, yeah. And in fact, we have the same problem actually if I did, printf of create string, right, that the thing we're printing out is no longer allocated when the function returns. So returning a pointer to something on the stack, that variable goes away when the function returns. So this code is going to seg fault. That string pointer is in fact going to be on one of our new thread stacks. It's going to point to there. Doesn't matter that if the pointer being stored on the main thread stack doesn't matter because it points to here. And that's going to disappear when the thread goes away. And potentially be reused, in fact, when create string returns. So if we run this code, we'll either get junk output, most likely, or a seg fault. If we're unlucky, maybe it will seem to work. But in a larger program, it probably won't work anymore. So what would be a fix for this? How could we make this code functional? Yeah.
Use a void star argument and then pass or have that point back or change the value that the void star points at. You cast the void star to like a void star.
So we're going to use this argument here, okay. And pass in what? Okay, so we're going to create a char star, and we're going to pass in that in main, and then we're going to pass that in. And then in here, we're going to not make this ignored. We're going to make this argument. And what are we going to do with the argument?
We're going to put, instead of returning string,
Okay, and then we're going to pass compute string with that argument. So I like this idea, except that we better declare the char star string in some way that allocates memory. Declaring a pointer doesn't make the pointer point to anything. So I like this idea, like if we make char string 1024 or char star string equals like malloc of something like that. Yeah, so that's one possible solution, is that we could say rather than having compute string allocate, make memory for the string, we'll pass in the memory to fill in. And since we're calling it, we know when that memory goes away, and we know it's going to be long enough for us to use it. Another possible solution would be that instead of having char string as an array, I could allocate it on the heap. And then rely on my main freeing it later on. I should write that actually out. that would also solve the problem, because then we'd be passing a pointer to the heap, and that's perfectly fine to do. It's not going to go away until it's freed, unlike our local variable, which goes away automatically when the function returns. Okay, so questions, comments on our what I call a dangling pointer example? Okay. So something to note with p-thread join. So we saw p-thread join lets us create, lets us capture the return value. This means that when we've created a thread and haven't joined it, even if the thread's exited, that thread's return value is sitting around for us just in case we want to join the thread. So this means that if I create a thread and don't join it, but it could be joined, I have a memory leak. Because that return value is going to sit around forever until I join it. Now there's a way of avoiding this. You can do what's called detaching a thread to tell the pthread library that, hey, I'm never, ever joining this thread. And that tells the library that it can just clean up the whole thread when it exits. It doesn't need to keep the return value around for you to collect later. So how do you do this detach operation? So one way is that you can pass a thread ID to the detach function, and that's going to mark that thread for later as I don't want to join it. Now this doesn't, do any synchronization thing. So in this example, I'm creating a thread and detaching it. Detaching it doesn't wait for the thread to do something or anything like that. It just marks the thread as this thread will not be joined. And probably it won't do anything until later when the thread exits. If the thread already exited, it's going to clean it up right now because it knows, oh, you don't need that return value. But most likely you're marking it as not needed for later. And it will just let you forget about the thread and not worry about a memory leak. And this seems kind of a little annoying that I create a thread and then I mark it as detached. You can, in fact, mark a thread as detached as it's created. So this gives us, finally, a use for that second argument to pthread create that we've left us null the whole time. So how that argument works is that there's this type pthread attribute t, and the people making the pthreads library really don't want you to know what's in pthread attribute t. So because of that, the only way you're allowed to manipulate things in it is through the pthread adder functions. And so you create a pthread adder t object, you call init on it, and you call destroy when you're done. What do I need to destroy do? You don't get to know, and the reason they're designed this way is because different platforms might do it differently. Like pthread init, maybe it allocates space on the heap for the information, maybe it doesn't, probably it doesn't. But they wanted to give implementations that flexibility. And we're going to call this pthread attr setDetach state function, sets a field corresponding to whether the thread starts to detach. And once we've set that, we can pass that to pthread create. It's going to read these attributes and say, okay, when I initialize this thread, I'm going to mark it right away as it starts as never being joined. Questions about our pthread attributes. So we're generally not going to use attributes in our code samples or otherwise, but if you want to do interesting things with the pthreads library, they use this pattern a lot. So there's other pthread tools we're going to see that also support attributes that we're mostly going to ignore, but if you want to change the settings for them, that's just how you do it. Another interesting attribute that the pthread library supports is one for stack size. So a question you might have is how big is the stack of a newly created thread? And so can you get away with doing tons of recursion in a new thread? And the answer, by default, is that it varies. But if we think of what was happening here, the stack kind of has to be smaller than our default main thread stack, because we have to put it somewhere in our virtual address space, right? Like, we can't do the thing we could do easily do with the single-threaded process of just having one stack at the top of memory, everything else at the bottom, and you have effectively infinite space on a 64-bit system for that stack to grow. That doesn't work so well when we're allocating the stacks dynamically. So they have to choose some size for the stacks to be. And you, in fact, can request specific sizes. So in this example, this code is requesting 32 kilobytes, which is kind of small. So why would you do that? Well, if you know you only need 32 kilobytes, this might save some resources or let you run more threads than you would otherwise be able to run. On a 64-bit system, probably the same number of threads you can run. Back in the 32-bit days, this was a bigger concern, where you could easily run out of addresses, but still saves resources in that the OS is tracking less space for you. So, and there are other settings you could set with these threads, which you can look up in the man pages. And some of them are going to be system specific, some of them are generic, and so on. Okay, so that's about how sort of creating threads. So we're going to go back to this example we showed earlier. So we have this code here, and remember what this did is we have our main thread, it prints about to start thread, it creates a new thread to run this print message function, and then it prints done starting thread. And the print message function prints in the thread. And I told you that when I ran this a whole bunch of times, about 4% of the time in the thread was printed, and 96% of the time it wasn't. And we learn that the reason this happens is that, well, when main returns, that means that the whole process goes away. But you might say, why is this a 4% thing and not a 0% thing? Or, why is it 4? Why is it kind of random? And that's because it depended on exactly when the OS and our processors had a chance to run each of these two threads, exactly how fast that was. And this ended up being non-deterministic. And we're going to call this a race. And the kind of the intuition that we'll call these kinds of issues race conditions, but the intuition you can have is we have two things going on. We have main returning and we have thread printing. And it's a race to see who wins. And the winner determines what happens. And the outcome could be different every time. And this scenario comes up in this case and had an easy fix. That the fix was that we're going to coordinate the threads by using join, or we're going to prevent main from terminating the other thread by using pthread exit. But this same type of problem is going to come up in a bunch of other cases where the fixes are going to be a bit more subtle, and that's going to be our main next topic, is about coordinating threads and dealing with these race conditions which occur in other places. So we just have these non-determinism, and we're going to fix our race conditions with synchronization constructs. And we've seen something that's in the family of things I'll call synchronization constructs, and that's pthread join. That synchronizes two threads. It makes two threads coordinate with each other in a predictable manner. So we can write code where the two threads are running simultaneously but working on shared things, and have that code not be buggy, not be non-deterministic. So to start talking about kind of more interesting race condition bugs, I'm going to do a hypothetical example of, let's say we have a server for a bunch of ATMs. So we have a whole bunch of ATMs in the city, and we have one server that they all communicate with that keeps track of all the account balances and so on. And this server is going to take withdraw and deposit commands from those ATMs. And we have some correctness goals. One of them that we're going to focus on is that we don't want to lose money. That if I deposit $100, that $100 better be accounted for. If I withdraw $100, that $100 better be accounted for. So we have this ATM server. How would we write this? So I might imagine we have some kind of main loop here, and I'm just like receiving a request from one of my ATM servers. looking at what the operation is, and say if it's a deposit operation, I'm going to, fetch the account information, update it in memory, and save the account information. Now, this is kind of like, this is probably like not what we'd really do. We'd really have a database and so on, but we're keeping things simple. Let's add this name this way. And you might imagine, maybe this get account operation, maybe that involves reading something from disk or contacting a remote server that actually stores this data. Maybe the same for the save account updates operation. Maybe we actually have a whole bunch of checks here, to make sure the deposit's okay. This is actually going to be pretty complicated, and it's going to take a while. And therefore, it doesn't really make sense to just have one copy of this loop running, because then you'd be sitting in front of an ATM, and someone else's deposit's being processed slowly, and it takes forever. So what we'll do instead is we'll handle multiple requests at a time. And there's a simple way of doing that. We have this loop that handles one request at a time. We want to handle 10 requests at a time. Let's run 10 copies of that loop in different threads. So we'll do that. We'll just run start a bunch of copies of that loop. Different threads, seems fine. And this probably will mostly work. And this is going to be a theme we'll have, is that most things will mostly work, but they'll sometimes really not work. And so my example of them really not work is we have this set up, and let's say we have two people who share a bank account. They both deposit money at the same time, okay? And we have two different threads running for their deposits. And let's say our initial balance is 500, and thread A has amount equals 100, thread B has amount equals 200. And here's our implementation of that code I showed you earlier. We do account balance plus equals amount, and we know that when compilers compile things like this, often we have to turn this into multiple instructions because we don't have the appropriate type of add to do that. If we think of what the assembly for this really looks like, right? Account is stored in a register, an amount is stored in a register, but they both access memory. This might be something we turn into multiple instructions. And in this case, the way that's worked is I turned it into a move into a temporary register, add in that temporary register, move back into memory. Very normal thing for the compiler to do. And if we simulate what happens with that code here, my initial balance is 500. So in this case, this is move the balance into RAX. So RAX becomes 500. I add amount, which in this thread is 100, to RAX. So RAX becomes 600. And then down here, each thread has its own value of RAX. Doesn't matter what the other thread's doing for the value of RAX. That 600 is going to go into the account balance. In the other thread, we're going to move our 500 into RAX. We're going to add our 200 to RAX and get 700. Then same value of RAX down here, we're going to move 700 into the account balance. So what happens is our final account balance is going to be this 700 here. It is the winner of our race. We have a race between these two. The winner is whoever goes last. They get to decide the account balance. And our update of the account balance from 500 to 600 just goes away. So here we have a write that kind of just disappeared. Now, the problem isn't actually that this write disappear. The problem is earlier. The problem is that we let thread B work on the account balance while it was in the middle of being updated. That's where we went wrong. That at this point, the value of account balance for reading is not the one we want thread B to work with. So in the future, we're going to talk about ways of preventing this. And in this example, I've shown you this with context switches. So our notion is that even if we have one core, you know, we can get unlucky, and we just happen to be switched from thread A to thread B just after thread A, right in the account balance in amount. And happen to be switched from thread B to thread A just after thread B, right in the account balance. So that's very unlucky. And you might say, well, that seems like that usually won't happen. And on a single core, the answer is probably usually won't. But, you know, when we have cache misses in the right way, maybe it sometimes does. But more likely what would happen is we have multiple cores. These two things would be running on different cores at roughly the same time. And we end up with the same effect, but not from tightly timed transit switches, but from having the different cores working at different speeds. So in either case, we've messed with our correctness property of having money not be lost here. So questions on how this scenario happened? So we're going to talk about a bunch of ways of preventing this problem over the next several lectures. And to think about that, we first want to think about, well, what generally happens when two threads are acting on common values? So let's start with, you know, some simple examples. So let's say here, I have x and y that are both 0, and thread 1 assigns 1 to x and y and 2 to y. After these two threads were finished, what are the possible values of x? So who thinks 0 is a possible value of x? Thinks 1 is a possible value of x? Thinks 2 is a possible value of x? Any other possible values of x? So I'd argue that our most logical thing to assume is that it seems like x and y should be independent values. And therefore, you know, these should be independent operations. That's usually what we'll see. Now, can we really say that? We're going to actually need some assumptions, as we'll see later. And you might say, why would it ever be different? Let's say, you know, what's really happening is that, you know, we have address 10,000 and x is the upper 4 bits of it and y is the lower 4 bits of it, then you might have a different opinion about what should happen there. But usually if we call them different things, we assume that this is not the situation. So how about here? What are some possible values of x? I'll give you a little bit of time to think about it. We'll see how many we can come up with. So in this example, thread A is the only thread assigning to X, but it's based on Y, which we know is changing because of thread B. Who'd like some more time? Okay, who can give me one possible final value of x? Yeah.
One.
And how did you get that?
If thread A runs before anything
on thread B. A, then B. Okay. How about another possible one? Yeah. 5, okay. B, then A. So we run all of B. So for 1, we run B. We run A. So A is 0 plus, A computes 0 plus 1 and puts that into X. And for 5, we run dread B. So Y becomes 2. Then Y becomes 2 times 2, which is 4. Then we run 4 plus 1 becomes 5. How about another possibility? Yeah.
3, if you run just the first expression, then A.
So this is B line 1, which means Y becomes 2. Then A, X becomes 2 plus 1. Then B line 2. Yeah. Any others? Oh, okay, we'll get back to our results. So how about here? What are our possible values of X? Someone give me one of them. Yeah.
One.
How does that happen? Yeah, so we run B, we run thread A last. Yeah. Remember, we have to run both of these threads eventually. But if we run thread A last, yeah, then 1 will be the winner. Another possibility? Yeah. 2, and that's from? Okay, we run A, then we run B. Any others? So, yeah.
Could you have like a random thing if they get swapped in between?
Could we have a random thing if they get swapped in between? So that's a good question. And I'll give a proposal for a possible random value of, let's say, the way these writes are implemented is that we write a bit at a time. In that case, we could write the 1 to bit 0 and then write the 1 to bit 1 and end up with 3. Now, almost no one like thinks this is a logical thing to happen, but like we need more information to restrict this. And we have a similar issue with our other example. Like we could imagine, oh, we get an in-between value from the assignment of Y. So we read 6, because we're reading half of 2 and half of 4. So we get a value of 7 for X. Now, you might sensibly say, these seem like silly possibilities that shouldn't be happening. And this is, in fact, the decision that processors have tried to make. But we need to be more precise about defining what things can and can't happen separately. So we're going to have a concept to refer to this known as an atomic operation. So an atomic operation is going to be something that we're going to say happens all together or not at all. There's no in-between step. And in particular, something we're going to assume is atomic is loading or storing aligned words, aligned values, is going to be atomic. Meaning that we're going to say, we're going to prohibit this possibility by saying, we're going to write the number all at once. That's actually going to be something that happens all at once. It doesn't happen bit by bit, so we don't need to worry about what if we're in the middle of writing it. You know, either the whole write happens before someone else accesses the value, or none of the write happens. We don't have an in-between state. And on most machines, as the slide says, loading or storing aligned values is atomic. Why do I say aligned? Because if they're in two different cache blocks, it's hard to actually make that atomic, right? That's two different things. You know, we have to access them separately physically, so that's not going to be atomic. But if they're in the same cache block, it should be atomic. And many instructions are atomic, but some instructions that you might expect to be atomic will not be. They will actually take place with multiple steps, meaning that it's possible to see in-between values. So we're going to have an example on the next slide to make this more concrete, but x86 has an instruction where you can add a number to a memory location. And if you followed the model we had before, you might say, you know, that was the problem with our deposit code, is that I used the wrong add instruction. I added to a temporary register. I should have just added directly to the value in the amount in the account struct, and that would have solved the problem. And it's easy to, I think it would, because the way I triggered the problem is by doing context switches. And we can't context switch in the middle of an instruction, because we need to finish one instruction, go to the OS, go to a next instruction. We can't jump to the middle of an instruction. We can only jump to the beginning of an instruction. But this logic doesn't work anymore when we have multiple cores. And another example of something that's very often not atomic is loading and storing values that cross between different cache blocks. But that sort of happens in all sorts of different orders, because we have to load the chunk in one cache block and the chunk in the other. Those are not going to happen physically at the same time, and we can notice that. Same with storing the values. We have to store value that's in crosses two different cache blocks. The processor will implement by storing one of them and storing the other. And those, you can notice that those happen at different times. So let's sort of make very concrete what happens when the integer add to a memory location isn't atomic. So here I have a program just to exploit that. So I have a loop that's written in assembly. Let's go through this assembly. So this function update loop takes one argument in RDI. And we access a global variable called the value. And I'm just accessing by its name. This turns into a memory instruction that writes to a constant an add instruction that writes to a constant memory address. So I'm adding one to the 32-bit value stored in memory at the address, the label. Then I decrement my argument RDI by one. And if the result is greater than or equal to zero, I go back to the beginning of the function. So we can kind of think of this. This effectively is a do the value plus equals one while minus minus argument is greater than or equal to zero, or maybe to make it more explicit, so arg minus equals one while arg is greater than or equal to zero. That's what this assembly code does. And what I'm doing with this assembly code is I'm running it as my thread function, so I'm passing it to pthread_create twice. So I'm creating two different threads that are running this function. And for the argument value, I'm passing 1,000,000. So each of the two threads, 1,000,000 times, is going to run this add instruction that's going to add one to the value. So the result we expect to happen, if you know there's no races, is that we're adding 1,000,000 times twice. So we're adding 2,000,000 times in total. So we'd expect a result of around 2,000,000. So questions on how I get that like rough expected result, and what this code does. We create the threads, and we're joining the threads, so we're waiting for it to hold all the finish. And I want to point that out because I'm going to have a histogram on the next slide. So I took this program and I ran it a whole bunch of times, and I plotted a histogram of the numbers I got. Since the add is an atomic, sometimes we're going to have these race conditions where, you know, we have our loads and stores, you know, we're going to have that lost write problem, basically. that we saw earlier with the account balance. And we're going to have that even though the add is a single instruction. Because the add is implemented in the processor in multiple steps, those steps can happen in a different order. And here's my histogram of results. Our 2,000 is this line here. 2 million is there. We usually, so this is not a case of, oh, usually it mostly works. No. This is a case of usually we get a very wrong answer. And in fact, a not insignificant amount of the time, we get a value below 1 million. How can we get a value below 1 million? What's happening there is, well, that probably basically one thread is reading a value from early on. The other thread does a lot of adds. The first thread writes a value from early on. The other thread reads that value from early on and uses that for the rest of the computation. So we can have a case where thread A like writes 1,000 and thread B, you know, reads 1,000 here after, you know, writing some other value, writing like 500,000, and then only adds a little bit to the 1,000. So because we have both reads and writes of these shared value, we can have like really weird things happen, and they in fact do happen. Like a pretty significant part of the time. And most of the time, it's kind of as if basically one of the threads wasn't there. And this is because kind of our processor implementation, you know, not only is it doing it in multiple steps, but kind of it's separating the load and store, and it's kind of doing the load early and the store late, because that's faster, as we'll talk about later. And this is something that is literally impossible to see on a single core, because in order for us to see this phenomenon on a single core, we'd have to context switch in the middle of this instruction. But on multiple cores, we didn't need any context switch to happen. We just needed the processor to be running the instruction in multiple steps. And we'll talk about later that even in addition to the processor running the instruction in multiple steps, it turns out the way the processor runs instructions is that it doesn't run all the parts of the instruction before all the parts of the next instruction. You might say, how can it get away with that? Well, it's faster, that's why they do it, even though it makes things a lot more complicated. So in addition to it being in multiple steps, like they're doing parts of the instruction early, you know, relative to other instructions, and parts late. Okay. So you might say this, like, how do we know what operations are atomic? Which ones are not going to have this sort of non-intuitive result? And there's kind of two answers to this. So the big one is that if you want to know, if you're writing assembly and you want to know what's atomic, the processor designer is going to tell you. If they don't tell you it's atomic, you better not assume it's atomic. And typically, processor designers will make very explicit guarantees. These are the things that are atomic. These are the things that might behave weirdly with multiple cores. The other part of the answer that we're going to get to next time is that if you want something to be atomic, that our threading libraries are going to provide you operations that make things be synchronized in a predictable way. And if you want things to be predictable, you better use those. And we've seen one example of those, pthread join. Pthread join is predictable. After you call pthread join, you know everything the thread has done is actually finished. You know, if the thread's doing a bunch of adds, those adds are done when pthread join returns. You don't have to worry about them being like in the middle of being done or not completely written out. And we'll have other constructs that are going to give us the same kind of guarantees. Yeah, and I guess, yeah, I I'm caught up with the other class, so I'll do one slide as a preview for next time. So here's something compilers like doing. That's going to be another reason we're going to want to, why we're going to have the solution of relying on what the library provides. And what has the compiler done here? It said, oh, you want the check ready? Well, I'm going to read it into a register, and we'll just check that register. You know, we don't want to keep accessing memory. That would be slow. So we're just going to put it in a register. If you're expecting it to be modified somewhere else, why would that happen? I don't see any code that modifies ready. So we'll talk about this issue and how to deal with it next time.